I think I'm going to begin with a wee little bit of a story. Yaroslav Pelikan, the great professor of Christian ideas, who was at Yale for many years and is now of blessed memory, said to me on one occasion, I'm not sure how our colleague here will feel this, but since he's a real Catholic, I think he'll be able to feel it just fine. We were sitting in the dining room of the Yale Club just across from Grand Central Station in New York. And we've been talking about a range of things, and I don't quite recall the context, but Pelikan is one of those few thinkers that the last several popes have always, and certainly John Paul II, had sought an opportunity, arranged an opportunity to meet with him when he was in America or when Pelikan was in Italy. Wanted to talk with him about a range of things. And, of course, he had written a book many, many years ago called The Riddle of Roman Catholicism. But Pelikan said to me, in his inimitable way, he said, if I was Beelzebub, I would have dictated Humanae Vitae into the ear of Pope Paul, knowing full well that Humanae Vitae, when it spread across the world, would completely make it impossible for the next 2-3 decades of the finest critical thinking about society that we have in the world to be heard by anybody, at least outside the church. But here we must, because it is an amazing tradition that can hold together things that most of us seek to split apart and not hold together. Or at least that's my view. Whether you like it or not, Catholic social teaching, if it does nothing else, it sharpens the critical perspectives of those that are willing to engage it, even when they dismiss it. So I am delighted that Bert Pitzel has joined us today for this cafe. He is a Saskatchewan boy, and as a result, most of us in Alberta are willing to grant him the status of being a supporter of everybody's second football team. And I suppose in many ways, at least here in Alberta, the province that some of us yearn for, and the politics historically that some of us yearn for, but certainly part of the great experiment of Western Canada. He was a teacher for some time, has said to me that in terms of his own Catholic formation, he's drawn to the mystical tradition. I recall an edition of Concilium, that great journal that Karl Rahner edited, which looked at political and mystical theology within the church. I always thought it was kind of an interesting sort of grappling within the Catholic Church itself. For the last 18 years, he has been the social justice coordinator for the Archdiocese of Saskatchewan, and has done the work of the Archdiocese in that area in many and varied contexts. So I'm delighted he's here. I'll mention two other things. He will be speaking on at Augustana on Monday evening at 6:30 to 9:30 or so, where we have a gathering around economy, market, and morality, a course that my colleague Dietmar Mundel has been teaching. And he will be speaking down there on opening up some of the perspectives that we have found coming out of the Catholic Church that critique the capitalist economy and hegemony, as well as that of course, the way socialism played itself out and seeks to point to another set of values. He's also giving on Monday, I guess 11:30 or something like that, to one over at the Catholic Archdiocese. There's a gathering around what the Archdiocese in Saskatchewan has been doing around restorative justice and what you've been doing around restorative justice. And, well, I know there is a very large wall around the Catholic institutions over there on the hill. I know that all of you have read about the Crusades and know how to breach that wall. So I expect that if you wanted to come there, you probably could come and sit in and hear that too. So it's great to have you here. And I appreciate the fact that all of you have come and that we will be able to engage this. Welcome.
First of all, David, thank you so much for having me here. Can you hear me?
It just stands pretty close.
Okay.
That's great.
Yeah, thank you, David, for having me here. It has been an occasion for me, at least for the last 3 months, to put my head where I have often put it these past 4 years, which is in the works of Pope Benedict Emeritus, who wrote an encyclical called Caritas in Veritate, Charity in Truth. And he did this in the light of the economic collapse in 2008. So what I received from that is a deep analysis from that. And I've always been challenged to go back to try and find out what the fellow was saying. I know that and I said this to David, is that Jacob wrestled with the angel for the purpose of getting stronger. And I say, I go to Benedict, and I've been body slammed 100 times, and I come back. Because somehow I believe there is something profound there that I need to try and get a grip on. And so this has been an opportunity for me to look once again at what I had been studying before. When I look out, as I am right now, I see many great minds, big minds, I think, and likely big hearts. And I'd just like to remind you, and there have been 2 books written on it, that small is beautiful. When you look back at me, perhaps you see small. And you might have to use your imagination to see the beautiful part of it. So what I would like to use as a metaphor or as an example of what the topic is about, prostitution, marketing, sexual favors, is this conversation that David hopes and I hope will develop. A conversation in which there is giving without loss. There is giving for the sake of gain. And there is taking without taking away. It's taking, and what you take away is for gain. And this is the kind of economy that Benedict is talking about. With a spirit that aligns itself with that outcome. Perhaps 2 examples. Blood giving. I give at the blood donor clinic once a month. I love the spirit in there. It's volunteerism is what I'm trying to say. So I give blood, and I don't lose anything. I think I gain something from that act. They take my blood, but they haven't taken away from me. They have given to me by giving me the opportunity to give. I go to the bank. I give blood. And in this case, when I give blood, it's taking away. Because who wants to pay three times an overpriced house and end up paying for 25 or 30 years on that? So I give, but I feel like something has been taken away. And reciprocally, taking ends up making poorer. And there is not the right relationship that comes out of that dynamic. In the topic of prostitution, marketing, sexual favors, I wonder which of those examples we're talking about here. That you give, but you gain, and you take, and you don't take away, you take away for gain. This is an example of, I would say, the second example, like the example of the going to the bank. It's reported as well that in a recent study, I think, in a polling, 80% of the people working have said that they don't enjoy the work that they do. Have I got that right? Has anybody got more modern statistics on that? 80%. That's about right. So you stop and think about that. 80% are engaged in some kind of work that they don't enjoy. And so they give, but I think there's a sense of loss there. And what Benedict is about, is he's about talking about constructing, developing, creating an economy in which that would not be the case. He talks about creativity. He talks about the fact that you need to look at who we are as people. One of his statements that particularly I've been drawn to is that he said that our understanding must go to a depth that will mobilize at the level of the heart to undertakings that will ensure that social processes evolve to be fully human. So he's talking really about change here. And it's change that comes from the level of the heart. And what he's saying is that we have to look at who the human person is. And he makes the point that people are made for gift. And if we act in any other way, then what we're trying to do is to prescind from who we really are, prescind from our nature. And when we do that, then what we do is we take from ourselves. We are not fully human. We are not fully alive. In his message, world message to the world, it was called Blessed Are the Peacemakers, he goes into this structure in this way. He said that in many quarters, people are aware that we need a new model for development and that we need a new approach to the economy. His whole idea of development is one of completeness. He said that if it doesn't affect a person completely, if it doesn't involve a person completely, and if it doesn't involve everybody, then it's quite simply not development. He uses the word for development, it has to be integral, involve everybody, and it has to be solidarity. It has to involve everybody, it has to be authentic, is the other word I want to pull in there. He says that a integral and solidary development and the common good really requires a proper balance of goods and values. So we need goods, is what he's saying, but we need also a scale of values. He says that while a wide variety of choices and a wide variety of goods can be important for development, what has to occur is that this be weighed against the horizon, he said, of an upright life. A good life, that he said, would acknowledge the primacy of the spiritual and the call to work for the common good. This is Pope Benedict talking. Now, he then goes into the fact that what is needed is individuals and groups of people and institutions to act creatively. That there has to be an innovation and a creativity, because who we are, to transform the culture in which we live. He said right now, what the culture, or what the marketplace is aimed at, or what the economy is aimed at, he said, is maximizing profits, and then seeing people only in their capacity to compete. That's all we get, is maximize the profit, maximize profit, and as well see a person only in terms of how well they are to compete. But he said, and he goes back to it, the human person is made for gift. And therefore, we need to develop an economy in which whatever we do economically is going to be expressions of fraternity. That whatever undertaking is taking place, there must be bonds of friendship that in a sense are formed between co-workers, between managers, between all who are involved in the various stages. We have stages of finance, location of resources, production, and consumption. Then he gets into the part which has to do with the part that the state plays. That states have to articulate policies, agriculture and industrial policies, which in fact strengthen democracies and lead to stronger constitutional states. He talks as well about structures, ethical structures that have to be created. And this is out of the creativity of people, is that there have to be ethical structures of currency and financial and commercial undertakings. He said that these have to be balanced, and they have to be coordinated, and they have to be controlled so that the poor don't suffer for that. And finally, he talks about there needs to be solidarity that existing at the local, at the national, and at the international level. And these must act in solidarity so that those people working in small, rural holdings, that they are treated with dignity, that they are, in fact, able to conduct economic activities that are maintained, that are sustained economically, socially, and environmentally. Just one last reflection here. He goes into how it has happened that we have the kind of society that we have had. He says that ignorance of our wounded nature is what gives rise to serious error, he says, in morality, in education, in politics, he said, and also in social action. And that for some time now, we see the destructive nature of the economic system that we live in. And treating the economy as an autonomous sort of entity that must be shielded against any moral influence has been what has been behind this. And that this has had great influences on other social institutions that have trampled on human dignity. And because of that, then we lose our personal and social freedoms. And then we lose hope in a society in which we live. We lose hope. We think that we're unable then to have some kind of integral development that we can participate in. Hence, 80% of the people don't enjoy the work that they're working in. So he said, what we need then is something that will impose itself on us. And he said that truth and love impose itself on us, and what happens then is that we're able to work for the greater good. I'd just like to pause for a second here and ask for a comment from the fellow who's holding his head, if please. No? Okay.
He'll comment.
Okay, he'll comment.
Yeah.
Okay, let me just go into this as the final piece of reflection here. So he says we're made for gift. And why is that? It goes into a deep reflection about who we are as people. So we go right into what he would say is the Godhead. These are not his words. This is my understanding of what he's been spoken over and over again. He said, God doesn't exist in a singularity, but there are three persons, one God. So if you just had the source of all being in life by himself, then you could not have something that could be called love, because love exists in relationship. And so the source of all being and life begets someone to whom he can give what is his to give. So we call that person, the second person, we call that person the son. The father and the source is able to anticipate what might be a problem. The son might say, just hold on a second here. Is this some kind of Trojan horse? Maybe you are giving to me something that is going to end up being a bad deal for me. And this is why we have the third person there, who is the revealer, who basically gives the meaning of giving and receiving. He says that this is going to end up in profound communion, a profound communion of joy. And so what you have then in Christian understanding is three persons, one God. Let me go to the next step here. Then comes the moment where the source would say to the Son, wouldn't it be a good idea if I brought forth something, someone like you, who could participate in the same way, who could receive and respond, and in that way share in our eternal joy? And the Son would say, count me in. The person who would be brought forward, us basically, who live in the cosmos, would be a living imprint of this receiver and responder. So what we would need to do then is do like the Son does, which is receive and respond. But the whole notion here is that the big idea behind this is gift. So gift given, and now are we going to receive the gifts that we are given of our identity and all that we are? Are we going to receive and respond out of that? He's saying that if we do not do that, then what we have done is failed to be the person that we're called to be. And the point he's making is that no economic system should prevent us from relating in that gifting way. And in the market system, where you have relationships controlled by exchange of equivalence of goods, if we gear our life only on that, then you have kind of a very weak kind of relationship taking place. And what we do then is we strip ourselves of the dignity that we are. And so the point then I would make here is that he's crying out that we be who we are, gifters, and that through that we create a new economy, one that is fitting for people to live in. How is that for a beginning? And we can.
Thank you. I wonder whether you would relate that to prostitution. I mean, it seems to me that critique is a critique of every kind of market there is. I mean, no matter what you're selling and buying. One would have thought that there would be some distinction among the things that, between the things that should go on the market or are properly marketed, mm-hmm. and those that aren't. I mean, does Benedict have anything to say about that?
Well, he doesn't have anything to say about prostitution of itself, but if you look into it, the question is, are the two people engaged in a true gifting of themselves? Are they engaged in an activity in which they are establishing their self-worth, that they are developing and growing in that exchange? Now, in the marketplace that we have, that is a perfectly fine arrangement, because the going price of someone who sells herself is whatever it is, and he's willing to pay. So there's a giving and a giving and a receiving and a receiving. But the question is there giving for gain, which is what gifting is all about? And is there a, is that reciprocated? So what he's saying is that this is demeaning to the people. It is not a situation which ennobles anybody.
Yeah, but this is interesting because it would seem to me to you know, say that there's nothing, what should I say, more demeaning about prostitution than, you know, maybe the majority of jobs that people have, right? I mean, most people sell their muscle power or their brain power for purposes that they don't entirely empathize with, and don't find, as you said, 80% of the people don't enjoy their work. Uh-huh. Must mean that they don't find it fulfilling.
Right.
So, I mean, maybe it leads to an interesting critique of that, that is that there's nothing particularly bad about prostitution compared with, you know, working on the railway or selling beer at the liquor store or any of these mind-numbing jobs that people have. I mean, nothing, you know, I mean, you might as well just be in the prostitution racket if that's going to pay better.
Okay. Catholicism makes a great deal of the being of things. So what is the being of politics? What is the being of economics? What is the being of a nuclear atom? What is the being of sexuality? Becomes the question. So what is sexuality for? And in Catholic thinking, you talk about solidarity. You know, because God is unity, he's absolute unity, total transparency, complete bonding. We are created in the image and likeness of God. No wonder we're social, and no wonder we hunger to be one with. No wonder we hung for solidarity. In the evolving of a culture, it sees marriage as fundamental. Because in a marriage, a good marriage, you have a caring institution to raise the child so that the child can be a healthy, giving person. And sexuality then relates to marriage in that if there is a profound intercommunion of two people and then they fly apart, then there is emptiness that would remain. So in marriage there's totality. You give yourself body, mind, soul, and you have a need for that unity, and you have a need for some kind of stable relationship for the sake of the children, who therefore can go out and contribute to society. So the way I would say that is that in this particular case, the meaning of sexuality is different from what it is being used for out there, and therefore it becomes destructive at a different level than someone who would be hitting spikes on a railway gang.
Much different?
Oh, yes.
Much different?
I would say much different.
In what way? I mean, given where you how you framed this,
yes,
it seems to me that what Pope Benedict is pointing to here is this very fundamental matter of relationships in which human dignity is not fully realized, or maybe cannot fully be realized.
Yes.
So Martin's point. I just wanted to push this a touch, mm-hmm. that in fact that critique is a dramatic critique,
yes,
of so much of human relationship, so much of our relationships to the economy, to work and what have you. And of course it builds on Pope John Paul II's extraordinary encyclical on work, mm-hmm. which I tend to see in very similar terms. I mean, it's carried forward that critique. That any work which actually does not make it possible for solidarity to come to exist, which does not bring forward the creative gifts of the human being,
yes,
is fundamentally a kind of a prostitution. To my mind, that is not a critique of prostitutes. It's a critique of a relationship which is tragic.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't about judgment. It's about tragedy and lack of human fulfillment.
Yes. There is a difficulty, though, if you have a child that comes out of that. And we would say also if there is an abortion, because you can't interrupt human life without there being some kind of a human revolt within yourself. So at that level, it becomes difficult. It also becomes difficult in the event as if you have an abandoned child in the midst then. So I think it presents, and there's also something very profoundly psychological that I believe takes place in the married act. So driving in a spike is one abuse of my giftedness, but then there's another abuse that probably has more profound consequences.
You're still going to hold to categories of sin.
I didn't mention the word sin.
I don't really mean to intend to put the fox into the hen house or the cat amongst the pigeons here, but I suspect that might be the consequence. I really have a lot of skepticism towards what men have to say about prostitution, because there is such a long historical double standard and hypocrisy amongst men and prostitution. Men have always condemned prostitution in public, but have been more than eager to avail themselves of their services in private. So most institutions, particularly the Catholic Church and other Abrahamic religious institutions, are so thoroughly paternalistic and patriarchal that I extend the same skepticism towards them as I do towards other accounts of prostitution which constitute part of the male legacy. So if I'm interested in the subject of prostitution, I'm very interested in what women have to say about it. And when we look through the evolution of feminism and feminist thought, we can see some interesting changes over the years, that the 18th and early 19th century feminists were primarily interested in equality. They wanted the vote. They wanted equal access to own and dispose of property. They wanted the right to enter the professions as men did. Then we move into the 20th century when the women's liberation movement, we find that women are more interested, well, they're interested in equality, but they're also interested in liberty and freedom, and particularly in reproductive rights. They want the right to abortion. They want the right to contraception, in vitro fertilization, and so on and so forth. So they want the rights over their own body. They want the right to choose. But interestingly, both of those generations of feminism were generally not disposed well to prostitution. They both regarded prostitution as an insult to woman's dignity. And made the very important point that prostitution was often highly correlated with sexual abuse of the prostitute in childhood or other forms of abuse which express themselves in the woman's willingness to victimize herself in the marketplace afterwards. What interests me is the third wave of feminism, which we see coming after the 1980s up to and into the 21st century. The third wave of feminism was always critical of the first two waves because they saw it as an expression of the Western, white, heterosexual woman that did not speak to the experiences and perspectives of the diversity which exists amongst the sisterhood of women, which includes black women, Aboriginal women, lesbians, transgendered women, and so on and so forth. And if you look at the literature of a third wave of feminism, you find that there are somewhat different attitudes than the first two waves, not simply towards prostitution, but towards pornography and other things. Like third wave feminists are much more likely to distinguish between what they call pornography and erotica. And they've no problems with
with looking at images of male and females copulating, even if it's images you have to buy commercially, whereas pornography is the absolute degradation and cruelty towards women and children. That's a no-no. But they don't have any other problems with erotica. And as far as prostitution is concerned, third-wave feminists make this general distinction, which might be oversimplified in some ways, but they distinguish between women who are out there because they want to be versus women who are out there because they have to be. And have to be often refers to pimps, but it also refers to these sad legacies of sexual abuse in childhood mm-hmm. and other psychological determinants over which we don't always have easy control. And I find that's a kind of a useful distinction to make, because Pope John Paul the 23rd, in his discussions of work, as David said, was actually deeply indebted to Karl Marx, because Karl Marx was the first important political economic philosopher to discuss alienation. He borrowed the term from Hegel, it's true, but in alienation he talks about how we are self-estranged from our work. We're alienated from under capitalism. We're alienated from the product, from the process, from other workers, and most importantly, we're alienated from ourselves. This is an aspect, a universal aspect of capitalism and commodification of labor. And as Martin says, it's an aspect of all forms of work under capitalism. So is prostitution an affront to a woman's dignity or a man's dignity? We have male prostitutes as well as female. Is it something which we should be censured heavily by socialists and by other activists, by women's activists? I don't think there's a consensus on that. And I'm interested in the third wave feminists who say, if it's a free choice, a woman should have a free choice over her body, not just for abortion but and reproductive rights, but if she chooses to become a prostitute for reasons which have to do with a free choice, which isn't because she was sexually abused or controlled by a pimp, then who are we to impose fetters on that choice? Yeah. And the last thing I'll say is there's such a huge difference between how we regard high-class upper-class prostitutes who were, in the Middle Ages, courtesans and geisha, perhaps, in Japan, because some of the courtesans in the French and British courts had tremendous political influence over the monarchs of their time. We won't go into the details there, but they were highly regarded. They were not regarded as street harlots or whores or whatever other abusive terms we use to describe sex trade workers historically. They were part of the aristocratic establishment. There's how we discuss prostitution is also mediated by the social class of the prostitute. When they were upper class, they were respected quite often. When they were lower class on the street, they weren't. Therein's my sermon for today.
Okay. My comments weren't directed to the female. It was directed to the participants. And the question was whether this would enhance their self-worth, whether this was within their dignity. I like to look to what Benedict said about freedom. He said that freedom consists of what the call of God is, and then when you respond to that, responding to something profoundly innate, you know, and relating to the conscience, I'll say. And when you observe that, then you are free. If you, in a sense, are not, then this whole thing of November the 11th that our soldiers fought to give us our freedom. Well, nobody can engage in a fight to give me my freedom. I can be in jail and be very free in some terms. Not free to move around, but I can be free as a human being. And what is the call? Well, the call is just to accept the person that we are given to be, and it is gift. And the nature of gift is always to establish a relationship. So you give gratuitously, and in the reciprocation of that, you have relationship. And I would maintain that in the case of prostitution, whoever the participant is, you wouldn't have a solid relationship developed out of that.
Both participants.
Yes, both participants.
Both.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. That's where my comments were directed to.
I totally respect your right to advance your own definition of freedom.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't believe in God, mm-hmm. so I'm not really attracted to the notion of freedom you've just outlined.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to put me up against the wall and insist that I give you a definition of freedom, which I hope you won't, I probably would, for want of a better, relapse back to Hegel's definition of freedom,
yeah.
which was recognition of necessity. And what that really means, I think, is a person who is really free has come to a full understanding of all the determinants on his or her course of action. Mm-hmm. Because only once those determinants have been grasped can they be overcome and controlled and directed
okay.
in some meaningful way.
Yeah.
So freedom for me is recognition of necessity. I don't really know, I don't want to take any more time, but I think that works both for the prostitute and for the client, actually, that as long as both people are party to a transaction, then they both have a good sense of what has led them to this transaction, and fully and transparently are conscious of that and willing to conduct their business, mm-hmm. then I think I'm the third wave feminist. I see it's okay.
Reminds me of Dostoevsky and Sonia.
Thank you. I was delighted to hear from the third wave feminist. I quite enjoyed that. I guess you quote Benedict thoroughly, and I assume that that's exactly your own beliefs as well. But you seem to suggest that only through marriage, am I not straight? Okay, thanks. That only through marriage can a person experience sex. Otherwise, all those people that have no opportunity whatsoever, there's no men available for women, for example, after a war. There's all kinds of other circumstances where men are not able to find a woman to marry, that they must be permanently celibate. Is that your suggestion?
Well, my suggestion is what is going to be humanly fulfilling. And to partake in sex, there are two aspects of it, and I'm giving you good Catholic thinking here, which you appreciate, is that there is a unitive aspect to coming together at an emotional, spiritual, physical level. And there is a reproductive dimension to that. It would be hard to argue that sex isn't about reproduction. And it would be hard to argue that somehow that isn't in the entire mix of what the Creator designed. So if someone were to argue with me that there is no Creator, that's fine. They'd have the right to do that. But I find it kind of irrational to think that being comes from nothing and that intelligence is born out of chaos. That, to me, is unreasonable. In an approach that I have given, I find that quite reasonable because I'm saying that the cosmos was created by a unity that always was, created out of love. And I think that stands up to reason very well.
I guess just in brief response, I think you're skirting around the subject.
Okay.
Just as I think you were skirting around the subject the topic that was at hand today. So I guess I cannot agree with what you're saying, and I don't feel that it satisfies me, I guess.
Yeah, there's also another form of prostitution, and that are those entrepreneurs that go into third world countries or developing countries and find a beautiful 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, make them a movie star, a model, haul them over here, put them up in a room, and collect maybe $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 a day without really any benefit other than like.
Do you have concerns about that? I mean, is this an area of meeting?
No, that's the reality, and I'm not approving of it at all. I'm just simply talking about those people who have no recourse to marriage. Yeah. And that was what I originally was approaching.
Yeah, but I think...
May I just make a comment on this?
Yeah.
You know, the Catholic world sits in a very particular place, and it has very particular ways of reflecting on these matters. And it has understood marriage and the sexual life to be very tightly bound to each other in a way that... you know, is not shared by all Christian traditions. But certainly it is one of the strengths of Catholicism is its way of thinking about that. I mean, strength in the sense that it's pretty consistent about that. On the other side of it, it's curious to me. I recall reading in the New York Times on one occasion when I was down in the States that I believe it was Pope John Paul II had actually spoken in, I think it was a pastoral letter, if I recall correctly, in which he said that it was time for men, by which he, of course, means Catholic men, those who are part of the faith, to realize that while the sexual life had something to do with procreation, it was not completely bounded by that. In fact, he went on to say, it is time for Catholic men to realize that in the conjugal embrace, he used that lovely phrase, in the conjugal embrace, they are to please their wives. And as I read this, I heard this great cry go up across the Catholic world. And I wasn't sure if the men were suddenly outed, or if the women were suddenly saying, oh, it could be more than that.
Okay. 2 points. First of all, I don't want to see this discussion go off on the question of whether the state or the church should outlaw or prohibit prostitution. That is impinge on men's and women's freedom in this regard. I think that's quite another issue. The issue is whether, as it seems to me, that prostituting oneself, and both men and women do this, and purchasing the services of a prostitute is to participate in a kind of sexual relationship which is very far removed from what is ideal or what is genuinely fulfilling to human beings in sexual relationships. I think that's really the issue here. I totally agree with people who say it shouldn't be outlawed. The state and the church in the past has been mistaken in trying to prohibit this. Trying to force that people into ideal states is definitely the wrong way to go and has counterproductive effects. Then I also wanted to say that it suddenly struck me when Tony was speaking about alienation that there was some sort of real kinship between what Marx was saying about alienation and what you said Pope Benedict was saying It's put in radically different terms, and I'm sure the theory behind it, of course, is quite different. But I suspect both of them are responding to much the same thing. I mean, it's the alienation that Marx speaks about is where a person has to do work. That they have to do work which they don't find fulfilling at all, right? And then they find what fulfillment there is for their lives in something other than their work, right? It seems to me that Benedict is putting that in this elaborate theological context, which I don't share. But I mean, it doesn't seem to me that you have to share that elaborate theological context in order to appreciate this reality. The question really is here: what are we to say about this situation? Is there anything that can be done about it? And when we think about things that way, whether those of us, and I admit to being among the people that I condemn, and that is who go around self-righteously, claiming, no, I don't deal with prostitutes, and I haven't sexually prostituted myself, or as though that was some great mark of distinction. I mean, if you take your God-given skills, and I'm using theological terms here for your benefit, natural given skills for Tony's benefit. If I use those simply to make a living, well, am I any better than the street worker? I mean, really, that's I think the issue that you have to face here.
Can we have a couple more responses to this, and then you can pick up on it.
I haven't read the parts of Sandel's book that may deal with this particular issue, but I think picking up on what Martin has said, I wonder if the situation of selling sexual favor, selling your sexual activity, is a type of transaction in which the doing of that actually erodes the meaning of the act. Not unlike the example where buying a tribute to a friend would erode its meaning. I think there's something similar in this particular situation. I don't know if that's the case where Sandel takes it. But it seems to me that at the heart of... that there is something at the heart of sexual intercourse, sexual exchange, that is about vulnerability and gift and sharing of oneself, that the selling of that somehow demeans and degrades the value of what is happening. And I don't, that's just a thought that comes to my mind in relating to the book that we've been studying. I disagree with Martin in that we should not seek to limit the harm that can do. I think there are cases where our societies do take action to limit what we believe may be harmful behaviors, even if people may be freely engaging in those behaviors. If we say, yes, there is some greater harm, I think I'm quite comfortable that as a society we do take, or whether it's the state or the church or others, say we should limit that, even if those who are engaging in it may feel quite free and unfettered, undamaged but there may be a greater societal damage. So that's maybe another point.
Could we pick up on one more?
Well, I would completely like to agree with Martin. However, I'd like to push it a little bit further. I think that on one hand, if you place so much emphasis on how important what you do is and the spirit with which you do it in, well, I don't see any reason why someone who sells the body, their body, it's their body if they choose to sell it, who sells their body in a way that they thoroughly enjoy doing and feel that in some way they are contributing to the well-being of another person by doing this, you know, I think that that meets your idea of gift and giving. Mm-hmm. And by the same token, if this is their only means of survival and they do it willingly, I see nothing any different between doing that and, say, being a waitress or being a clerk. You can, what you do doesn't matter. It's the spirit in which you do it that matters.
We just have one more, and then you can pick up on it if you'd like.
Okay.
Are there things you would like to respond to?
I guess I just have to repeat a couple of things. I say that Catholicism places much importance on the being of a thing, and the intellect can discern the essence of a thing. It can discern its limitations, its strengths, and those kind of things. And the human person is a being of a thing, too. And I would say with a conscience, and that is God-given, that you can discern within yourself a call to do good and avoid evil that is not of your own making. It's there. It's a given. And that we who are the being of a thing can read the being of things of other things, and it's their glory, their fulfillment to organize these things in a way that will work for the good of every person. So therefore, we go back to the economy. The economy should assist in people being able to find their fulfillment. And if the economy is way out of kilter, then perhaps it becomes, I will say the word, reduced to the kind of situation that you're talking about. But nevertheless, there is still something we should be aiming for. And that is, this would be good Catholic social teachings, the dignity of a person in a community that is formed out of the common good, which is upheld then, we'll take it to the global level, upheld by subsidiarity and solidarity. The whole idea that we are to form one human family. Subsidiarity means that you don't take away from a person the thing that they are able to do. That decisions and responsibilities should occur as near to the individual in community as is possible. That pertains to their dignity. And if you don't do it that way, then you lose the gift. And if you start having massive organizations imposing a way, then what happens is you are forcing people, you're enslaving people. They do not have the ability to give of that which they're given to give. And as a result, then the human community suffers. They lose the gift of that particular person. So I'll go back to the original premise. I would say the original truth is that we're made for a gift. We're given, which we are to give to for the enrichment of the group. And in that, we find our fulfillment. And so then with sexuality, we should be able to, with a clear mind, discern what the purpose of that is. well, let's see, there are organs. Let's see, there is such a thing called conception. Let's see, there's a thing called human beings that arise. Let's see, we have to take care of human beings. What is the institution that can take care of human beings? And so all of this, I think, ultimately works out so that each human person is to be served. That would be the aim. And of course, we have deviations from that.
What about this idea of gift that he's put forward here? How do you see that?
Well, I don't see why in a sex act by a prostitute or any other act by a prostitute, this could not be interpreted by her in all sincerity mm-hmm. as a gift to her client. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, would also be receiving it. It's possible he would also receive it in the spirit in which it was given.
Yeah. It seems empirically, let's do it this way, is that associated with that, and you can contradict me, is oftentimes drug addictions. Like, what do you do with the ensuing loneliness? Well, you have an internal drug line that you can tap into with dopamine and endorphins. Dopamine kills pain, and endorphins give you a pleasure, a sense of pleasure being fulfilled. That's over with, and now suddenly the director of the brain takes over and says, what on earth is this all about? So what we have to do is to make sure that we are a person who's well integrated. And that what it is that we do doesn't violate our sense of peace. And if it is violated, then the question is, so what do I do about that? And if there is a need then to go to the drug solution, ultimately it isn't a solution at all. It's very destructive. But the only thing I can say is I go back to what is the being of the thing of sexuality as you study it in nature, as you study it in human beings. We should be able to figure that out and then put it all together so that it'll work for the good, not just of that person or even that community, but in history, in history. And
but we're also moving into a new world. As Tony was outlining, we're changing, we're evolving. And conception in the future may all occur in test tubes. And it may be very, highly programmed. Sex. Sex may be relegated to a very different place in society.
So, see, and that would contradict my idea of gift. Gift is it's outmoving. It's concerned about its giving of self for the enrichment of the other. Now, if we turn into ourself, we might think that we are sole authors of our life, sole authors of the life around us, and that we, in fact, should engage in social action that basically makes the world like we think it should be, rather than what it might look like with a theological perspective.
Or with surprise.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, as usual, I try to oversimplify things. But I would go back to what Martin started to say, and the lady over there kept on, that basically, I think what your definition of gift is a very peculiar Catholic definition of gift. My definition of gift is a little broader.
Okay.
So we go back to what the lady was saying. I don't see why donating my body and getting some money in return is any different than doing a job I enjoy to do and getting paid for it. Uh-huh. In fact, going back to what you said, 80% of the people at work are unhappy with what they're doing. So they're really prostituting themselves in a classic sense of the word. But if you do something because you enjoy doing and you are bringing I'll say, you're fixing a car, you're doing the best job you can, you enjoy doing it, it's good work. Mm-hmm. If you, you know, are something else, and you are just doing it for the money, then that's prostituting. So we can broaden the scope and say 80% of our society is prostituting themselves on a daily basis,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the prostituting of sex is just simply, you know, at this point, we are getting too much into the Catholic tradition.
Yeah.
So that, we should stay out of that.
Just before, if I could just say one thing here, is that the whole question of addictions, there is no addiction which is freeing. And there seems to be a whole lot of addictions related to sexuality, pornography and so forth, even going and revisiting a prostitute over and over again. You are not free to say no. The brain likes to develop a habit, you know, and it seems to be getting some kick out of this. And then, lo and behold, a day or two later, it says, what the heck was going on? This was not fulfilling in a deeply human way. So all I'm saying is that we need to engage ourselves in a way that is deeply human, and it has to exist in an enriching relationship. And I think we get into trouble again for about the fourth time in the being of a thing. What is sexuality? And if it is not engaged in a fully human, healthy way, I believe it becomes an addiction. Yeah, well, addiction. Catholics do have addictions, but I think addictions are in abundance, crossing all through the human family.
I want first to thank you for your comments. I found what you said very moving. Moving not so much to persuasion as to a kind of nostalgic wish. but the clarity of the commitment with which you speak really is compelling.
Yeah.
And so out of that, I would like to shift ground a little bit from the immediate issue of pornography, prostitution, to the reasons that you bring to bear on that.
Yeah.
I can't resist just a little aside, though, first in saying and remarking, I'm the father of four children, and of two I'm the natural father, and of two I'm the stepfather.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that indicates the way the world has changed.
Yeah.
And any theology that would draw a division between my responsibility or love for those children, I don't think you're saying that, but I do think it's a difficulty with that position. What interests me more, though, is this. You mentioned that 80% of people don't enjoy at all the jobs they're in. There are people in this room who have labor union or human relations experience who can speak to that. The very high incidence of the use of psychotropic drugs among university staff is really just dismaying. The fact that I'm told close to 80% of the senior executive class of the Federal Civil Service is receiving some kind of job counseling really says a lot. But it also raises a question, which is, these are very well paid and expensively educated people who are in the top decile of their community in terms of their opportunities in life.
Yeah.
So why do they go on working in those jobs? Why don't they take the pay cut and do something else? Now, I just want to cite that as a problem that bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, the issue I would like, and I'm sorry if this has taken so long,
but I
come now to the question that a lot of us in this room are interested in and troubled by what we see as a shift from a traditional society with a plethora of religious traditions, but which overlap and which generally support the same values.
Mm-hmm.
The shift from that toward a secular society with particularly secularization of value.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the issue, the discussion we're having about sexualization and sexuality sort of indicates that in a way, with you speaking very clearly and committedly from a, if I may put it this way, a religious perspective,
Catholic, yeah.
And confronting much more secular views, it's a, it's my body, I can do what I want, or it's pleasure, and I'll pursue it whichever way I want. So now, the question that concerns a number of us, but myself, is twofold. I mean, the first is, well,
and by the way, I've asked Don to do this. As soon as he's finished, we'll take a break, and then we'll come back to take this on, okay?
This is meant by way of a kind of commentary or an agenda question for you. So the one part of it is to get at the loss of value, the when we shift from talking about love as an instrument of intimacy or of engagement to sex as an instrument of pleasure. That's one. Mm-hmm. But the other beneath that is the fact that you use the word should so much. We should do this. We should see it that way. We should see it that way. And I think a lot of us want to agree with you on that. Like, but those executive officers should do something about their working conditions and don't because they value something more. You know, so when you say they don't like their jobs, but they love the income and they wouldn't trade the jobs with that income for more fulfilling work.
Yeah.
So the evidence of people's inclinations points toward individualism, secularity, pleasure as fulfillment. And it seems the only way that you can give political effect to those shoulds is by legislating in a way that will stop people from acting out their own inclinations.
So we'll come back.
Okay.
We'll take a break for tea.
Can I
then we will come back and enter into what Don has laid out for us here. Thanks. Thank you, Bert.
Okay.
Shall we return to our conversation? Would you frame this again for us to refresh people's memory?
Individualism, consumerism, utilitarianism.
Okay, it starts with the fact that we've been spending a lot of time looking at Sandel's case, and he has two issues. One is a fairness, unfairness issue about selling things being for sale, but the other is that when certain goods are for sale, there's a corruption of value. Now, sexual services seems to be a clear example of that, as in the case of prostitution. So that's the background to this. And then the second bit of background is that very frequently, that issue has come up in a way that has juxtaposed secularization with traditional understandings of value. And where those traditional understandings quite typically represent a kind of overlap of agreement on what's right and wrong or good and bad, although it may be anchored in a variety of different religious sources. So what you get there is, what we seem to see here is a juxtaposition between a traditional and religious-based understanding of what is valuable and what is humanly valuable on the one side, and then its corrosion through increasingly giving up that way of thinking about those things and trying to think about them instead just in terms of individual gratification and individual rights. So then that said, I mean, I'm just trying to use that as framing background to where we are. So you come in, if I could put it this way, and give this... Well, we won't hold his choice of football teams against him. You come in from an alien culture. And give a very moving view of the place of sexuality, which is interesting because even people, many people here, I think, who are come to these issues from with religious convictions don't share yours, actually. So the first, that's the first issue. Like, how do we? It's great to have a very profound individual ethic, but how do you get that ethic widely understood and accepted in the society when very few people accept it? And then the second part of this is, particularly when the actual behavior of people is that they prefer the more, let's say, vulgar, corrupted value. If we did a survey today, I suspect we'd get a whole lot of people agreeing that sexuality ought to be seen in certain terms, but the same people would agree that they don't see it in those terms, right?
Is Rob Ford going to be reelected? Yeah. A couple of things here that I didn't mention. In the creation of a new culture that is more attuned to the dignity and the freedom of the individual person.
What Benedict is arguing
right,
for.
He mentions,
arguing for this change.
Yeah, he matches an economy of communion, which means that it's not based on equivalence of values of service and goods, but rather it must be enter into human judgment as to what will be a gain-gain situation. So if my neighbor, for instance, say I'm a farmer, and he comes and helps me, say, butcher my pig, you can't relate this to this at all, I'm sure, from your background, but that work might be only worth this much. And yet, I look at his family, and I see that there is need. And so what I do is I find a way to give him half the pig so his family will not starve, you know, or will at least have some full meals. So you would call that an economy of communion where you value relationship so that in giving there is gain, and in that giving on a human level there is gain. He's gained a friend. He has not done anything that would imply this is a charity, social welfare at all. But he talks about a economy not constructed so that money must make more money, which is what has been downloaded on us against people's wills. But he talks about an economy in which everybody has something to give and something to receive. And so I guess it would be the human judgment at the civil society level that can bring this about, as you know your neighbor and as you know his need and all that sort of thing. And what you prize above all things is the relationship. And that's why I say made for gift. When you give, it's not out of someone controlling that you should give. It's because you want to establish a relationship. And so, in my theological understanding, we are a gift. We have things that we're given to give for the sake of relationship. And continuing on in my understanding, we've screwed it up. We've decided that the one who is the impulse of gift through whom we were made is somebody we should not pay any attention to. I am self-sufficient. I'm on my own. And then, of course, I become confused about what happiness is, and what happiness is some imminent form of material progress, and that seems to work for a while. And I'm confused about what salvation is. You know, what is it that can touch me and make me fully human and fully alive, which is what I want. So instead of probing the issue at that level, what we do then is we try and make the world according to our own image and likeness, you know. And so then that confuses. the issue. And to me, the issue was, if I could just finish this, like Joan of Arc, this 14-year-old girl brought before a quasi-religious legal court, and she was posed a trick question. And the question was this: Joan, are you in the state of grace? Which means, are you in friendship with the one who made you so that you listen and you respond? Now, this is a trick question, because if she says yes, then they'll say, are you sure that's not your pride acting? Which would give, net you some more questions. If she said no, then they'd say, well, so that everything you've been about is wrong. So what she says, this 14-year-old girl, she says, if I am in the state of grace, I pray God I stay there. If I am not in the state of grace, I pray God put me there. And there was stunned silence. And to me, that is at the heartbeat of what we're talking about. Are we in the friendship of the one who has created us? And if we always remain in the friendship, then we're going to act as co-creators with the one who put us here, who creates out of love and out of goodness. So everything that we string together, put together, having viewed the being of things and their importance, we try to make them work together so that there is human fulfillment. That's and by the way, the cultural values that Benedict names, he says, not individualism, consumerism, and utilitarianism. And that stuff is in the air that we breathe, and we pick it up, you know? And then we do, like we heard. He said, rather, fraternity, reciprocity, and solidarity. And so we can stand on that, fraternity. I can judge, fraternity. Reciprocity, reply to, and solidarity. Believing in the power of small with my intimate group, and giving what is mine to give, what we do is we carry an impact of an internal sort that's going to impact through history, is what I would believe, that will go towards shaping a culture, and it is not confined or derailed by any economic system that is made so that money must make more money. So,
if I can just tease up a little part of this, Bert, or ask you to shine another light on it. You have talked about his comment about the power of small.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, for so many in our world, when they look at the history of Roman Catholicism, mm-hmm. and we look at its, you know, its enormous gifts, but also it's, you know, it is this peculiar body, because it is the last of the Italian city-states, as well as a religion that reaches into the lives of more people in more cultures over more time than virtually any other. But it is the last of the Italian city-states as well. And so it has historically had this capacity to exercise political power. Now, my reading of the documents of the Second Vatican Council is that they finally took the Protestant principle into the church, and flowing from that, several popes have insisted that anyone who is a clergy person cannot be a politician. You have to separate. So it finally brings about, began 1,000 years ago, Catholicism began to create the secular world, I think, in my view. It was its first gift to us under Henry IV and Gregory VII, and coming down to finally, in the 60s, bringing that fully forward. Here is my query to you. Do you see this kind of apology, in the best sense of the word, that you have been giving, this kind of set of insights based in this particular ground,
mm-hmm.
which speaks about the gift of life and the need for solidarity and the need for doing things in this way. Do you see that
as, and was the Pope here speaking to Catholics and saying to them, you need to carry this forward into all aspects of your life, also in your deep personal life. You need to do life this way. But because you do life this way does not mean that you shape social, that you shape political policy around this. They're different things. Mm-hmm. But this long legacy of doing it politically on the one side makes so many people so suspicious, you know. And of course, I began by quoting my old friend Yaroslav Pelikan on Humanae Vitae, and this is part of what was going on there. The endeavor to see that birth control would not become part of what was available within a society for all of the reasons, and for all of the marvelous way in which I think Humanae Vitae speaks about the sexual life. But the habit of mind in Roman Catholicism, I think, down to Humanae Vitae, I think it shifted a bit myself, and I think you're a witness to that.
Yeah.
The habit of mind of having the ideal, the perfection of the idea, and driving it down into social policy, and then trying to get the state to back it up. How do you see that point? It may be helpful to hear about that.
Well, first of all, St. Francis of Assisi was a power that transformed the medieval church. And I think it's very significant that Pope Francis has adapted that name. And his message to us is get out there on the fringes. Be a messy church. Out clericalism. If you want to talk about abuse within the church and all of that, point to clericalism and that whole thing. So Francis is very much concerned, I think, of what you said. And I don't think there could be a Francis without a Benedict. You know? And, kudos for Pope Benedict for resigning. He saw that this was so much, and it was a great tradition that he basically broke. And now Francis steps in. And basically he's saying what has always been the underpinning of Catholic social teachings is option for the poor. If you believe in solidarity and the dignity of the person, just like in any family, you go to the one that is weakest and most vulnerable, and you serve that person. John Paul II himself said that the poor are an institution of higher learning. If you want to learn what it is that brought them there, the poverty, and of course that is going to include the various, the history of how things came to be in that culture. You have now positioned yourself for a great learning, and then what you must do is you must learn so that the work that you do is a liberating work. And what you do is you seek the good of the other, and then you use what is yours to give in order to bring about that good. And just one other thing, justice and love. Love is about seeking the good of the other and giving what is yours to give for the benefit of the other. Justice is to give to the other what is theirs by virtue of their being and doing. You know? So the question is, how do you bring about a just society without love? You can't do it. You would have to sort of impose it. Or you can do the 99% solution, the Occupy movement, and get so much of a social movement that you in some way have the strength, the political strength, to require social distributive justice coming from the 1%. Now I think what Benedict does, if I can go back to that, is he goes beyond that. He says it's not just about seeking justice, it's also about being who it is that you are, and not prostituting yourself by engaging something that would shortchange you. An image that comes to my mind is a little pipe, you know, that is represents the exchange of goods and services of equal value, and taking a bouquet of flowers and pulling it through. You know, we have that beauty, we have that expression that is to benefit the human community. You know, and when we prostitute ourselves, I mean, I'm becoming very familiar with the word now here. We cheat the human community and history of the giftedness that was given for its, call it, perfection. And what's one question I haven't answered here except many of them?
That's okay. Fine.
Yeah.
You don't have to answer any questions here. You need to raise them.
Yeah.
May I have our colleague speak?
Oh, yes.
Thank you. I guess I my nature is to reduce a philosophical question to a more practical one, and I, if you'll forgive me for that, I can't help thinking perhaps about...
Forgiveness is a Catholic term, you know. I might be careful.
Okay. I keep thinking about our good Catholic wife who does not use birth control, who is satisfying her husband's needs. You can call that love if you like. Maybe it no longer is love, and she has 12 children. She doesn't want any more. Now, to my mind, the practical reasons for that are probably the well-being of her children, the fact that she doesn't have any other means of sustaining herself, so she submits. And I call that close to being prostitution. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Close to her, is it?
Is it? Well, all right, I'll say it is. I was being a little careful.
First of all, yeah, I come from a family of 17 children, okay? And there's woundedness from coming out of a large family like that, because the attention that we received wasn't there as needed. And yet it was a powerful gift as well, and not one of us are unhappy that we were born and that we saw our mother do what she could do within her power to give of herself for that life. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's the plan for all women, but in that whole humanity question, the question isn't so much about birth control as it is about openness to God. Am I breaking with the friendship of God by what I do? It's the Joan of Arc. Am I in a state of grace? Now, I don't think it's up to someone to come and tell you what you can and you can't do. But what they can do is to sort of inform and show you at a fundamental level what the choices are and what's going on. Catholicism always says that the supreme court of decision making is a well-informed conscience, you know, and so that would be the question that would have to be wrestled with, and I would say it happens a lot within the framework of their pastor, who helps them make the best decision that is there for them to make. It's a conscious decision. It isn't basically say the hell with the institution, that sort of thing. They address the question about am I cutting myself off from God? Am I retaining that friendship with God like Joan of Arc was talking about? And so it's only with great struggle and difficulty that one would come to a decision on that. And Humanae Vitae says there is an intimate link between life ethics and social ethics, and then they will go on with that. So,
can I just respond to
the
illustration, the example that our colleague has laid before us?
Yeah.
I've known a lot of priests in my time,
mm-hmm.
and a few of them have even given me a blessing on occasion. I have had the pleasure of talking with them about their receiving confessions from people. Obviously not not breaking the seal of the confession, but about that whole process. And in the best, of course, it's a wonderful way of seeking some kind of healing and finding your way through. But a number of these priests have certainly said to me that there was a period in the church, maybe it exists still in some places, when in fact the teaching that we see manifest in Humana Vitae was interpreted as the mother and the wife is simply, I mean, the text that they have told me was in the mind of the woman was, be it done unto me according to thy will. And that wasn't about God, that was about her husband. And that this was deeply, deeply polluting. And deeply, it's a kind of bondage. And that they had a struggle, certainly from the Second Vatican Council on, they had a struggle working with the people in their community to say, no. That is a complete misunderstanding. That's not what this is about. You are the image of God. You don't have to assign yourself to something, the transcendental, as if the transcendental passes that down to you in the abstract. It is about you and about your being, which I think is what Benedict is saying.
That's right.
You are it. So, here's my final response to this. There is a spiritual mother in the ancient church and several church fathers who say that the commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, is primarily sinned against in the marriage bed between the husband and wife married to each other. Why? Because, to come back to your friend Benedict, because lovemaking, which I think is the lovely word for it.
Yes.
Conjugal embrace sounds very Vaticanese, kind of abstract, even though we know that Pope John Paul II knew more about this than most, perhaps. But the act of lovemaking is an act of communion.
Yes, it is.
In the ancient church. This is the visceral communion.
The first communion.
And so it is a profound, you know, it's a metaphor for the whole nature of what Benedict is saying and what this tradition is calling for, a whole way of trying to orient your life that way. Orient your life around communion, not around alienation.
Yeah, that's right.
But what would you say to our colleague and friend here about that habit of mind that has existed or whether it exists now? Do you agree with me in what I've said about that?
First of all, we are a wounded church. We're having a sister, Luella Kenny, coming to the Archdiocese, and this concerns the sexual abuse. She is a nun who is also a doctor. And what she did...
And she's also great.
She was asked to attend a number of hearings and conferences and that sort of thing. She's written a book called Healing the Wounded Church. And she was trying to identify the number one reason why there was this passing away of priests who would abuse one more time. And she pointed to clericalism. And she said, this whole, and you can feel it in some, this whole sense of entitlement. The Jesuits, I find, when you speak, you're speaking to a brother, you know, at a human level. That's my experience. If there isn't a profound understanding, which is able to give compassionate service, then I can see this, combined with clericalism, I can see a very unhelpful set of directions coming out of that, and a very fragmenting comment coming out of that. And there are still many hurting people who put up with clericalism in their own parish, not out of sexual abuse, but just that sense of entitlement, mama's boy, all those kind of things. And what I say goes, and that sort of thing. So we are a wounded church, and we have, call it sins, weaknesses, the whole thing to overcome. But But the good news for the Archdiocese of Regina is we're, the bishop sent out a letter, please come and have a look at this, listen to this lady. So there is a soul-searching reflection on the culture of the church.
I think, you know, and that's marvelous, and I think that lots of dioceses are undergoing that process.
Yeah, yeah.
But to the point of our colleague,
Yeah.
I mean, just because this is a historical thing. I mean, do you agree that in fact there are these situations in which women, mothers, wives, where they really ended up becoming, having child after child after child in a way that really was, it's not that the child was wrong, it's that the caring wasn't right.
I was number 12.
Yeah.
And the thing was, is that my parents did go to a priest about this thing, you know, this seems to be getting quite a number, out of hand kind of thing. And
did he explain how it happened to them?
So of course the word came down, you know, that's would not be acceptable.
Yeah.
So my mother died and rose with the Catholic faith, and that's what they lived by. She always said, this was one of the things that impressed me the most about her. She says, you don't know if you can do something until you're there.
So I appreciate what you said and what you said about your mother.
Yeah, but...
but that's not enough.
Okay.
We're talking about an issue that just wasn't about your mother, but an issue that has to do with several generations. It's not a pastoral question on this level. It's a question about the need for couples under that circumstance. Do you agree that in fact the priest should have responded differently? Which isn't to say he would necessarily recommend birth control of a chemical nature, but he would say, look, this is not appropriate. This woman, your wife, who you say you love, this is not a proper manifestation of love, because it is a form of bondage at this point.
Absolutely, no doubt.
That's all we want to hear.
Absolutely, yes, for sure.
Well, I want to go back a little bit to some issues that were raised earlier and indeed at the very beginning of our session. And I think I want to make four points. One, we forget too easily that we live in a world of relativity. Some things are relatively good. Some things are relatively not so good, or even relatively evil. But we always have to think in those terms. We have to balance advantages and disadvantages, and this is why an ethical life is such an intricate proposition. So I think we have to bear that in mind as we evaluate the situation of the prostitute and the worker. Point two, coming as I do, and I'm proud of it, from a long line of Huguenots, I nevertheless find the papal approach to the economy immensely sympathetic. And I think that it was very helpful to have brought that out at the very beginning, and the definition of an economy in terms of a proper economy, in terms of something that promotes brotherhood and solidarity. I think this is immensely valuable. Now we have to look at other aspects. The sense of gift in that context as being something that enriches the giver. There are other kinds of gifts. You can go and buy a $50 card for Canada Tire, and it's monetized. And you can give it away, and it's a gift in a way. Maybe you like the person you're giving it to, but it's still monetized, and $50 is taken off your bank account. And when you go into the bank, as you pictured yourself doing, as soon as you get that sort of monetary scale, you're in a different world. And so you have to try to see these things in relation and keep them in the perspective of better or worse, rather than right or wrong. That was point two. Point three, I'd like to pick up the questions of the navvy and the prostitute. The navvy spending his day breaking rocks for the railway. And he doesn't like it. He doesn't enjoy his job. Is he prostituting himself? Well, has he made himself any worse by spending his day breaking rocks? Maybe there was something better that he could have done, but maybe he couldn't do it. Maybe he needs the money. But he's still presumably hale and hearty at the end of it, and we trust he has a good meal somewhere and a proper wage and so on. So is it prostitution? Well, in the end, of course, there's a railway. This is a social good.
That's right.
And it's hard to see how a loss has occurred. So the prostitute who sells herself or himself, at the end of the day, is there a good? Maybe there's a relative good, but maybe there's something else. Say, a relationship, a marriage relationship that is being violated by this process, and you have to factor that in, and you have to make a judgment about the gains and losses in each case, and they may not come out the same, and I actually don't think they do.
No.
And in fact, there's a kind of middle case that would puzzle me a little bit. If I were a black in Zimbabwe, and I gained my living working for a white tobacco farmer, maybe the job is okay and I get paid. Maybe I even find it reasonably satisfying. I'm making something that is going to be put on the market, and it's going to contribute to the economy because the market is going to say the tobacco company made a good profit this year. And then people are going to take the product and kill themselves.
Yeah.
So you have to you have a real problem, because the economy that tobacco firm contributed to is not the economy that Pope Benedict was thinking about, I don't think. And so there's a case where you're going to have to balance quite a few advantages and drawbacks. And I think it's a sort of middle case.
Yeah.
Point four. So we have to look at our hierarchy of values, and the Pope is setting out a definite hierarchy there. Have we got the right hierarchy? I think he has, but that has to be discussed. And when we have our hierarchy, we don't follow it. We look at the better, and we do the worse. I think it was Horace who said that originally. We live in a society, and we live a life. I live this life every day. I can see what I should be doing, but I'm very rarely doing it. How can we construct a society in which, with our sinful impulses, we are nevertheless encouraged to act in accordance with our better nature?
Okay.
And that, I think, is the essence of the prostitution problem.
Okay. Can I respond to that?
Thank you. Sure.
Okay, I'll go back to Benedict. And he talked about gospel beatitudes. And he said that in those, there is a promise. Jesus makes a promise. And fundamentally, it's those who pursue the requirements of truth, love, justice, and freedom will find themselves, will find that God is with them. Now, then he goes on to say that Jesus purifies the impoverishment that humankind brings to that search. Just exactly what you said there. And in terms of that reflection, when we see the extent that he went to live the requirements of truth, justice, freedom, you would say, like the Roman soldier would have to say, truly, this is a love that goes beyond what we have. He would say, truly, this is, and the pure love is God. Truly, this is God. We might even come to the point where we can, like Thomas say, when he sees the suffering that this cost him, he might even say, my Lord and my God. Now, with that profession comes, he said, an extraordinary experience of fellowship with God. And this is back to the Joan of Arc question then. Am I living in the state of grace? And one of the great difficulties we have is when we think that we can conquer evil on our own, says Benedict.
He also says that one of the great difficulties is when we think we can live perfection on our own.
It
works both ways, huh?
Yeah, Matthew uses perfection twice, doesn't he? One is having to do with forgiving the enemy, and the other is trying to follow Jesus perfectly. I think he only uses it twice. So that sense of perfection, not kind of a legal sense of following the law of perfection. So then comes then when we know the truth about God's love for us, we are opened up to gift. And then we can have hope in a participation in true integral development. And he says hope is what's missing. Hope encourages the mind and strengthens it to direct the will. And the will, of course, means participation in the power of small to go and be gift. So therefore, this truth is not something we willed, not something we planned for, but it's something that's imposed on us with an ability then to pursue this life of giftedness, which is not on our own strength.
One of the other things that I appreciated about Pope Benedict in some of his writing on other religions and on the secular is that he also understood that that kind of response and a notion of giftedness was not bounded just by Christianity.
Yeah, that's right.
Because it's part of human nature, of human nature.
Yeah. In Catholic social teachings,
yeah, course,
it will say
yeah,
every
yeah.
person has a glimpse yeah. of God, yeah. which is an experience.
We have a final comment here. Maybe it'll even involve a benediction of some sort, since we have brought together Pope Benedict and the last of the Hebrew prophets, Karl Marx.
Actually, I should apologize before I say anything, because I'm the worst person to bring to a close these proceedings, and I hate to be the fly in the ointment here. And I have the greatest respect for your views and your rights to express them, but mine are somewhat different. So, in conclusion, from my own view, just as I said earlier that I don't trust anything said by men about prostitution because there's such a long history of a double standard and hypocrisy, I also don't trust what any large capitalist organization has to say about social justice and the redistribution of wealth. Because the Catholic Church has to be one of the largest capitalist institutions in the world, which a tremendous accumulation, concentration, centralization of power and wealth. It is a multinational corporation, and it has done the same harm as an institution to the poor and wretched of the earth as the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization. And child abuse and pedophilia is just the surface. I mean, unfortunately, the Catholic Church isn't the only institution which collaborated with Nazism and fascism during the Second World War. It's not the only institution which tolerated right-wing brutal dictatorships in South America and other parts of the world, but it is one of them. So, having grown up in a Catholic country myself, we always made the distinction when we talk about Catholicism, we distinguish three different levels. We distinguish the level of Catholic people, the ordinary people, many of whom suffer and struggle for a living like anybody else. Then we distinguish the level of individual priests, some of whom are good, some of whom are not so good. And then at last we distinguish the top level of the ecclesiastical hierarchy, who have countlessly disgraced themselves historically and politically on so many different occasions. Mm-hmm. So I guess in conclusion what I would say, and I don't mean to be harsh about this at all, but what I say in a desperate effort to find a point of linkage between our two discourses, and I am trying, I think the point at which I would reach out is with those individual Catholic priests, particularly South American priests, who kind of tried to work with the ordinary people, who tried to contribute to developing producer cooperatives and self-managed enterprises, and many of whom associated themselves with the trend of liberation theology, some of whom were excommunicated by the Holy Father for their activities, and generally speaking, for many popes, the Catholic, the liberation theology was something which was not approved of at various levels. But those are the levels, the priests who have worked for the people, who have done, tried to do as much as they could, who, like Archbishop Romero was assassinated, and it's El Salvador, and Papa Wyszko, if you remember him in Poland, he was murdered by the Stalinists there, as Romero was murdered by the fascists. So if we want to talk about social justice and the ending of prostitution in a large sense, because I sense we've moved beyond sexual favors, not we're talking about work in general, I would like to redirect us back to the discussion of work that Marx, because Marx believed that labor or work was one of the most important criteria which distinguished human beings from other members of the animal kingdom. Why did he do that? Because in his view, work is what enables us to transform ourselves. It's what enables us to build continually better environments. And we are the only species that can live in Arctic environments or in Sahara or sub-Saharan environments, because we have the ability to work and reconstruct our environments. No other creatures have the ability to transcend their environmental thresholds like we do. And for Marx and for other philosophers of that tradition, work was a way of self-realization. Whether you believe in God, whether you don't, it doesn't have to be an issue. We can all agree that work is a way. And by work, we mean the ability to reflect upon ourselves, to construct positive purposes, to redesign. Yes. But I do think that has to be done by the people themselves. And in the same way, as I said, I don't believe a large capitalistic organization like the Catholic Church or any other such transnational enterprise is going to be trusted by the rest of us.
Okay. It's lovely to hear you channel On Human Work by John Paul II from Karl Marx. Absolutely perfect, because John Paul II used exactly same terms. And I suppose it's the common Polish experience. The one thing that I take from your comment, Tony, and from yours as well, Bert, is this heightened realization of just how frightfully human the church is, and that this is an ancient institution and a whole range of things trundle along inside of it. I'm delighted that Pope Francis seems, at least in terms of his posture, to have removed himself from the throne of an imperial kind of papal throne and restored himself to Peter's chair, to a fisherman's chair. We'll see how that works out. I wish that I could, in a single-minded way, share your perspective. But unfortunately, we know of the Soviet Union, and we know of China, and we know of Pol Pot. And so what you really are signaling, and justly so, is this extraordinary ecumenism of tragedy, sorrow, abuse, and misunderstanding of what it means to be human. And the Catholic Church deserves your critique. And has within its own body, of course, as you well know, many that make that critique as firmly and fiercely as you do and are seeking to pull life from death in the midst of it. We'll see if it moves 2 or 3 degrees in the rest of our lifetime. Thank you so much, Bert.
Okay,
appreciate it.
You.